feel free to cover your ears because I'm about to correctly predict the rest of the book. You ready? Okay, so on the map, the last three are clearly Skybreaker, Windrunner, Bondsmith. It doesn't really matter what order you go through. The last three are almost certainly Skybreaker, Windrunner, Bondsmith. We get eight, right? We go to the Windrunner one, and then we're like, oh, wait, the Shaman's not here because Moash has the sword. We go to Ishar in the Bondsmith one, and Ishar says, hey, you need all nine swords to come talk to me. You haven't finished your quest yet. So then they go fight Moash, and then they come back and then fight Ishar and then get 10. That's the rest of the book. Welcome back to Following Noah on a Stormlight Podcast. This week is episode 244, and we are in chapters 53, 54, the end of day 4, interludes 7 and 8. Paul, how are you?
Oh, wonderful, Trevor. Any time I read something where Zeth draws Nightblood is going to be a great day for me. So yeah, I'm doing pretty good. I'm excited to look further into these chapters with y'all. As always.
Yes, indeed. He's fighting two honor bearers, one of which I'm not convinced is there again. So
honor bears?
Honor bearers? Is that, did I not?
I didn't know honor bears were a thing. Anyways, is that a different type of care bear? Like an honor bear? Anyways, I'm sorry. You go ahead. Elliot, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. We're chugging through this book. I had a pretty funny conversation just the other day. Somebody who knows I'm reading these books kind of checked in with me and said, you know, asked how Wind Truth was going. I said it was going great. We're through the end of day 4. We're at page, 550. And he said, oh, page 550. So like less than halfway done. And I just had shared a nice chuckle with him that we can be 550 pages into a book and not even be that close to halfway. Insanity.
Well, we are close to halfway, but we're not quite there.
Close is like 680 or something like that.
Something like that.
Yeah, we're like 100 pages away from halfway, which is, it's a ways.
Paul, do we have a patron?
Trevor, thank you for asking. You know, it was very kind of you to ask, and you asked in a very kind way. So yes, I will share that we do have a patron this week. And I'm very happy because this is a very fun name and a very kind person who stopped into our Discord and said hello. So I'd like to give a shout out, of course, to our ardent Quax. Thank you so much, Quax, with an X, for your support. Very much appreciated. This week on my mug, this is a mug that my wife and I just happened upon for free. I don't know. At some point, someone gave this to my wife at some event, so we have it. It's a lovely kind of periwinkle color. I don't think that comes through on screen, but it is for Visiting Angels Living Assistance Services. And
I don't think know what periwinkle is, but continue.
Okay, I promise it looks different in person than it does on camera. I'm very sorry. It is like a bluish purple, which is like periwinkle. So,
do I not know what periwinkle is?
Periwinkle is like a purple, right? But it's kind of like a bluish purple. Yeah.
I thought periwinkle was like a purplish pink.
He's married to the interior designer. We probably shouldn't question him.
Alex is a color consultant by trade, but that does not mean that I'm right. I'm not going to stick too firmly to this. Alex would know. But anyways, my pun is that Quax, you are our visiting angel, and thank you so much for your support. And I guess shout out to this company. Anyways.
Thank you, Quax.
Thank you so much, Quax.
Thank you, Quax. In all seriousness, Quax did they signed up on our Patreon and then sent us the most sincere and nicest message I've received in quite a long time on there. About how all they want to do is on their day off, take their dog on a walk and listen to our podcast. And I feel honored to read that. So thank you for that. All right, Elliot, Can you give us a brief summary of 53, 54, and the interludes before we do our two words?
Sure. So 53 is Zeth and Kaladin continuing their jaunt through Shinnevar. And Zeth, I think this is playing off the scene where Kaladin has just finished playing the flute and dancing with Syl in the wind, and Zeth's over there just kind of sitting there, and he finally gets up to like say something, takes a step, and falls straight into Shadesmar, where he is attacked by no less than two honor bearers who are coming after him. No punches pulled, no holds barred. Trick him into Shadesmar and double team him to try and take him out. And it's not good. However, this is Zeth we're talking about. And this is Zeth with Nightblood. And I don't want to get too much into this because it's going to be absolutely insane to talk through this with you guys. But needless to say, Zeth survives, defeats the Honor Bearers, gets back into the physical realm, and then just continues on his chat with Kaladin as if nothing too big has happened. But we've now collected two more Honor Blades, and on we go. Chapter 54 is back to Shallan and Relaine and Renarin. They're kind of questioning where they go next. They're seeing images of Ba'a Edo Mishram everywhere. We get a little bit of Relaine backstory, which I thought was actually pretty interesting. And then we close out day four with a little bit of Adolin and a little bit of reflection on his end and discussion about his friendship with Yonagon. And then we then shift into interludes, another set of interludes, interlude seven and interlude eight. Interlude seven is our boy Moash. Moash is back. Moash is in the story, apparently, and we get some Moash perspective. And yeah, we'll talk about that chapter, but spoilers, Inquisitor Moash? Oh my. So
I called this.
Oh, you did.
Only a couple chapters ahead of time, but I did call this.
You did. And then interlude eight is back to Odium and his ongoing dialogue. And it does feel like a dialogue, actually, because you have emotion side of Odium and logic side of Odium kind of going at it. We get full on emotion side of Odium, and it ends with war is the only way. Nice and ominous there from our evil baddie.
Sounds good. Paul, do you have two words to summarize what you pulled out of these chapters?
I do have two words, very quick and brief, not super deep. Light and sight are my two words. Light for Nightblood, which we'll talk about, becoming not like a black beam as he's drawn, but a big beam of like light, like a radiant sunshine almost. Interesting. And sight for Moash. Trevor, you did predict this, and I'm very proud of you. Doesn't it feel good to kind of make a prediction and then read, and you're like, what actually happened? Or close
it does, to, it does we, feel yeah. good. I will give myself a pat on the back for that one.
It's nice. I'm realizing you haven't really had that opportunity, because Elliot and I have historically been the ones to be like, yeah, this might happen, and you've already read it. So welcome. It's fun.
Thank you. I feel like it wasn't that big of a prediction to make. It was rather foreseeable by everyone except for Moash. So yeah, I feel okay about it.
That's fair. You were integral to putting the pieces together, because we were like, who's blind? You're like, Moash is blind. And that's pretty, like, there we go. That makes sense.
Elliot, two words?
Two words. I do have two of those. And I'm honestly pretty shocked that Paul did not beat me to the punch with these two words, because there were only two possible words I could think of to describe these chapters, and they are draw me.
Oh, I thought you were going to say light blood.
No. Although that,
night
that
light.
Is good. That is good.
That's my joke is night blood. Night light.
Night light.
I'm holding to.
Light water would be the inverse of night blood, I guess. Anyway. Draw me. Anything besides night blood there, Elliot?
No, self-explanatory.
Okay. Right into 53. Well, actually, I lied. Not right into 53. I do need to acknowledge the epigraphs. I'm not going to cover them unless you guys want me to pull out my book. It was more excerpts from our overly scholastic Words of Radiance excerpts. And I mean, I didn't gather too much from them besides like Skybreakers back in the day went out of their way to look after the people who were overlooked by the law, which I felt was a more proper adaptation of a Skybreaker oath, like justice, like making sure that everyone is, no one is overseen by the law. That seems more correct Skybreaker to me, which was in the excerpts. But other than that, I didn't get much.
The only other thing I latched onto, I was reading fairly closely because Skybreakers, we need as much as we can get out of those, speaking as a Skybreaker Radiant myself. I took out that revisiting yet again multiple factions within the Skybreaker Order and pointing out the fact that there's schisms and conflicts of ideals within the Skybreakers themselves, which I think we already knew, but it's just continuing to bring that up.
Yeah. Other than that, now we can go to 53. And like Elliot said in his summary, immediately Zeth stands up, takes a step, and he's in Shadesmar. And I would like to take this opportunity to laugh at which one of you had Kaladin enters Shadesmar on their bingo card. Okay, Elliot, because I read that or I listened to it and I immediately thought, oh no.
Elliot's gonna get so excited.
Elliot's gonna get the freest bingo slot on the face of the planet, and he doesn't go. He doesn't go, so we're fine.
That was one of the ones I've like written completely off of my bingo card of, bummer. Me we're too. Not going that direction at all. There's no way that's happening. And then chapter 53 and Zeth is all of a sudden out of nowhere in the middle of Shadesmar. I'm thinking, all right, Kaladin's going to dive in after him. He's going to come save him. I'm going to check this box. I'm going to win this bingo thing. And Kaladin doesn't even know the whole thing happens. Like Zeth just does the whole duel battle and then just comes back and they keep chatting about Stu.
Yes. I did get rather concerned about your bingo card. Like, your bingo board has a lot going for it. That one is not one of them, and I was going to get concerned about that, but we're good. Zeth falls into Shadesmar, fights off two honor bearers, and I was trying to think, are those the next two we were going to go visit, and they just came to visit him? I was trying to do the flashback to our episode where Elliot and I predicted the order of where we're going to go in, and I think these are the next two, and then Lightweaver's the next one after that.
Yeah, I was going to ask this exact question, Trevor. I don't remember the exact order. My head is telling me that Edge Dancer was the next one, and we did have the Edge Dancer Honor Bearer. Like, that's for sure. It was the Edge Dancer, and what was the other one? I don't remember off the top of my head.
Edge Dancer and
Elsecaller. Okay, that's what it was.
Because they used the Elsegate to warp him in there.
That's right. Okay.
Gotcha. I think this might be slightly out of order from what I claimed, because we were going off this map, or at least I was. There's a map in the book that shows all the different monasteries.
Pause there. Paul, you might learn something about your phone. If you open your Audible app to your Wind and Truth and go to your more options, you can find an accompanying PDF and it shows you all of the art in the book.
I did not know about this. So I will go, be capitalizing.
Go find your accompanying art. Don't spoil yourself because you can press next and go like 100 pages later.
That's fair. Yeah, I'll be very careful because it's very comical listening to the illustration descriptions. Like, it's so hard to follow having someone audibly describe it to you, you know? So I always try to make a point to go grab my book and go look, but that'd be wonderful. So there we go.
Yeah. So you get cool maps on your phone. Anyway, Elliot, you were saying?
I can't honestly remember what order I said they were going to be in, but Edge Dancer Monastery is right in the middle of Shadesmar, and all the rest of them are kind of out around the edges. So we've snagged all the southern monasteries and the middle one now. So we'll see where we go next, west or east.
So, okay. I have a couple questions for y'all. First of all, why or how do y'all think that this happened? Because in my head, I've imagined that all of these honor bearers will be in their monasteries, kind of minding their own business. I guess word is spread about Zeth coming to Glenn's land, Zeth coming back, and so they've been proactive in seeking him out. I guess, I wonder if they're in cahoots with, do we think they're in cahoots with Ishar, and Ishar can use connection and kind of let people know, I guess? Is that maybe what's going on? It seemed interesting. It was kind of a little kickstart to the rest of those, rather than just like, oh yeah, Zeth arrives at another monastery, fights the guy, then goes to another monastery, fights the guy. Like, it's...
They say some interesting things creative. While they're battling that might tell us a little bit about this. One of the things they say, I think it's both of the honor bearers, is they keep talking about, Zeth, you are seeking the position, and you are not worthy of the position.
It's been thousands of years since anyone held the position. You can't have it. It's just like, what the heck are you talking about?
And the Edge Dancer girl is like, oh, I'm going to take you down so hard that I'm going to get the position. And Zeth is in the same boat that I am of what?
The immediate conclusion I jump to is, oh, hold all the swords at once.
That's exactly what I was going to say, Trevor. That's what makes sense, is you earn all the honor blades, and therefore you have the position of maybe honor. Who knows?
Let me caveat that. Hold 9 of the blades at once. That could be a title. Because at the... I always mix them up. The Recreants. I always mix them up. Whenever they leave Taln in Damnation, there are 9 blades there, and then right at the end of the vision, a Shin guy walks up. It's like, oh, there's 9 swords here, and the vision like leaves. So I wonder if that guy got a title of holding 9 swords at once. But then...
Maybe, but I feel like this is a little bit different. I feel like this is like you've earned all the honor blades by whatever might mean. And I feel like it would be 10. And I feel like that would explain why maybe in my head, whoever that was who stumbled upon the Circle of 9, very ominous, by the way, to be that guy. He wouldn't necessarily have like a position or something crazy happen because he picked them up. And it may be because he picked up 9 instead of 10. But we do know that Taln's blade is here.
Yeah, they have it.
Yeah, they already have it. So it's like, we're on track to get that 10. Does Ishar still have his?
Yeah, so this is why I brought this up. We're actually on track to get 8. Because Ishar has his, and Moash has Yezrian's.
That's right.
So if we wanted to get 10, we'd have to go fight Moash, who has coincidentally come right back into our story here. So
I was gonna say, yeah, well, we are starting to see that. And if they're so okay, I'm assuming Moash is going to fight at some point in this book, right?
Yes.
There's some justice that needs to be served, and there's some moments that need to happen,
or redemption.
And I'm expecting that will be. So part of me is like, of course, that's like a Kaladin fight. Like that feels relevant, but also it feels like it's Kaladin's battle to fight, but I don't know if he will be willing to pick that fight, if that makes sense, with where Kaladin is now. I don't actually know. So I'm just saying I could see a world where Zeth is the one to fight Moash. Moash is kind of like, if we were looking at like raw, like combat power, I feel like you would have like the contest of champions, if you will, being Moash versus like Zeth. You know, I feel like if you were just looking at like raw fighting strength, you know, that like that's kind of the situation you'd have. So I feel like that'd be a pretty epic battle. I feel like there would even be a really cool way that Brandon could kind of mirror that with the duel that Kaladin and Zeth have at the end of Words of Radiance, and like a cool like kind of I don't know, meaningful sense. That's going a little bit far in speculation. I don't know if that will happen, but I digress. I'm saying I could see a world where Zeth does get all 10, which would be interesting. Hey, I don't know if anything would happen.
Feel free to cover your ears because I'm about to correctly predict the rest of the book. You ready? Okay, so on the map, the last three are clearly Skybreaker, Windrunner, Bondsmith. It doesn't really matter what order you go through. The last three are almost certainly Skybreaker, Windrunner, Bondsmith. We get 8, right? We go to the Windrunner one, and then we're like, oh, wait, the Shaman's not here because Moash has the sword. We go to Ishar in the Bondsmith one, and Ishar says, hey, you need all 9 swords to come talk to me. You haven't finished your quest yet. So then they go fight Moash, and then they come back, and then fight Ishar, and then get 10. That's the rest of the book.
I mean, as far as the story goes, I'm here for it, I'll be honest. Also, I'm going to say something briefly in passing that I don't think y'all are going to agree with, but I feel like the position is going to become holding the Shard of Honor, and that Zeth is actually going to hold the Shard of Honor rather than Dalinar. I think that's where his story's headed.
Wow.
I'll just throw that out there. I think he is not seeking that power, but he is learning honor versus following the law. And so I think that's what's going to happen. I'm pretty convinced at this point.
Does this like kind of assume or point to that maybe, oh, what's his name? Why am I blanking on it? The honor vessel guy.
Tanavast.
Yeah, that one. That like Tanavast had all of these honor blades, or he created them when he was splintered or died or broken or something. Like that was the moment that honor no longer existed and he divested it. Is that
I think he like gave them to the heralds, but I don't know if we know.
So yes, he gave them to the heralds as far as we know. And here comes some speculation. I think the Oath Pact having all the heralds stick together, I think is going to be important. And if you split up the honor blades, that might actually split up honor, is where I'm going to go with this. So if you only send Tullin back by himself, you send 1/10 of the honor blades back by himself, you've then damaged honor, like the shard. And so that's when honor dies, or is susceptible to dying, is when the Oath Pact is broken and 1/10 of honor goes back to Braze. So I think Mistborn spoilers, if anyone cares, when AT and what's Preservation's vessel's name?
Laris.
Thank you. When Laris surrenders himself for the humans, gives himself partially to the humans, it makes him marginally weaker than AT, and AT is slowly able to chip away at Laris. Same thing. When the Oath Pact is broken and Tanavast is 1/10 weaker, I think that gives Odium his door, even though the Oath Pact or our heralds didn't know it at the time that would be how they'd lose.
That makes sense. And that's something I hadn't thought of. And it definitely makes sense with. So the prime candidate has been Dalinar, right? Dalinar is actively seeking the power of honor, right? Right. And he has made such a specific point to uphold oaths that he makes. Like, whether that's a promise to a brother, like to people around him, and his like literal, like his radiant oaths and things like that, that's a big deal. So it makes sense that the Oath Pact being broken would weaken honor, because that's likely something that was made under him, right? So, man, I that seems legit. That's kind of cool.
A lot of this is going to come down to the timing, though, and this is what Dalinar is trying to find in the spiritual realm, right? Is I've been assuming, I don't know what I've based this on, maybe it's just wrong, that honor is going to be splintered, I guess, prior to all the Night Radiant stuff. Whereas it sounds like, Trevor, you're spinning, he's splintering later, much later, potentially. So right. It might come down to that timing. When did that happen? When did Honor die? And that's the question Dalinar's trying to answer right now too, right?
Right. Nightblood.
Yeah, I was going to say, I was really throwing out some crazy stuff, but getting back to like what's literally happening in this chapter, I wanted to point out, so Zeth is battling these two honor bears, and he's fighting the honor bearers, and it's absolutely an unfair fight, and he admits it. He's like, what do you expect me to do? I'm unarmed, and there are two of you. And I'm drowning in the beads and Shadesmar. Like, this is so unfair. And so his Spren is there. And he's like, please, can you help me find a weapon? Anything? Like, just give me something so that I can at least, hopefully, not die. Right? And his Spren brings him back a wooden spoon. And Zeth gets very frustrated at that. Throws it at him. And...
I was so hoping for a stick. I wanted a stick. I was so hoping for a stick.
Oh my gosh. That would have been funny. I didn't even consider that. That's hilarious. Yes. And have the exact same dialogue that I am a stick. He so could have brought that back. Anyways, brings back a wooden spoon, is unable to do anything with it, just throws it at him. And he starts to hear the voice of Nightblood calling out to him. And eventually he finds Nightblood is all the way at the bottom of near the bottom of Shadesmar, like near the like in Shadesmar, the land, which is the water in the physical realm, right? Finds him, is able to begin fighting back, and so on. But before I talk about Zeth drawing Nightblood, what are our thoughts on the Spren situation? Is it just the Spren is not very good at this? Is quite a hectic situation, or is this complete, like, malicious or, like, sabotaging? That's the right word, I think. Definitely is, to my in my perspective, absolute sabotage. The Spren, you know, Zeth is, like, obvious. Zeth feels something is up. Like, he says something. I can't quote it to you, but he thinks something about, like, he's beginning to trust his Spren less. And starting to see that he doesn't necessarily believe all the things he's being told, things like that. And it's definitely been set up for a while that this Spren with Zeth is quite fishy. Like it's sort of worked, but it's very perilous. Like the situations that his Spren will like allow Zeth to get into. So I don't really know, but I wanted to know what y'all thought about that. Is this legit? Is the Spren okay? Is this negligence?
I have a question for you guys. How does Michael Kramer voice the Spren in Shadesmar versus the real world? Because it's described as being a very different encounter, like a very different person. And I want to read more into this. If there's like this goofy voice maybe associated with the Spren in Shadesmar, does that happen or no?
It does, but not in the way you're thinking.
Okay.
It's the same person, but they're way more like vulnerable and a fish out of water in Shadesmar.
But it's noticeably the same.
It's the same voice. Yes.
Okay.
I was going to say I wasn't specifically looking for that, but I did not notice anything different.
Okay.
In the voice. Nothing stuck out to me.
I was curious about that. All right. Yeah, it's very odd. It's very odd. I was not ready for that because our High Spren buddy, I at least have not liked him so much. We've talked about Skybreakers and does not seem to be the best influence on Zeth, very much playing tug of war with Kaladin. Kaladin's doing all his therapy on Zeth, starting to make progress. We've seen some progress on Zeth in the last few chapters, and the Spren is in Zeth's other ear the whole time going, don't listen to him. Don't listen to him. Don't listen to him. Do this. Be stronger. Yada, yada. And then he pops into Shadesmar and the Spren is just useless. Like a clumsy goofball almost this whole time. And what is going on here? Is this all a facade? Is this all a front that the Skybreakers are big and tough and actually they're just goofy people who don't know what they're doing?
No, I don't believe that the Skybreakers are secretly goofy and don't know what they're doing, because as a Skybreaker, that is not acceptable. However,
well, I think I think Elliot has a point.
This Spren has been put up to it is the conclusion I have come, like, I had made that conclusion already, but this reinforced it, that whether that be Nail or Ishar or Odium, whoever wants to manipulate Zeth, the list is quite long. Whoever put this spread up to it, the spread is not well practiced at this. And so whoever told the spread, hey, go boss Zeth around, all you have to do is act tough and he'll listen to whatever the heck you say because he's Zeth. They had a point until this line, which Paul, I'll quote it for you. He says, in my training at the Lightweaver Monastery, they taught me something about facades. And when you have a captured audience, you can never let the audience see the facade, because you can never regain the lie back. That's how the chapter ends. And I'm like, heck yeah. So I'm actually really curious where this Spren thing is going now. I wasn't super interested in Zeth Spren until this chapter, of how much is Zeth going to push back and to what and when, how quickly.
So is now the question, is Zeth going to, or has he already realized that he's being manipulated, that he's being controlled in a way that he shouldn't allow himself to be? Is the next step for him to break out of that, to disobey the Spren, to push through that barrier and go his own direction? Is that where we're going with this? I could get on board with that.
Yeah, absolutely. That's been my thought as well. I don't know when or how this may happen, but I definitely think that is the direction we're headed. I think it felt clear to me from this chapter that Zeth no longer trusts this Spren, and he's beginning to more so trust Kaladin and his own judgment in a way. And wow, it makes me so happy. I'm so proud of him. And I feel like we've made some big steps in the past couple days. I definitely think that he's going to some way break off from the Spren, but I don't know how that's going to look.
I think he's made some baby steps in the last couple days, and he's about to make some big steps. So
I think you're right, Trevor. But I feel like Zeth has been the most consistently rigid character throughout this whole story thus far, like every page we've read. And so those baby steps, the change in thinking, it's not, he hasn't acted on anything really yet, but it's the change of how he's thinking through things is what I think is really impactful. And exactly, it's the baby step that's going to project him way further forward, I think. So I'm all aboard.
We could be headed to the Lightweaver Monastery next. That could be the moment where the illusion shatters.
Anything else for Zeth?
Well, are we going to talk more about Nightblood?
Oh, Nightblood. Yeah,
yeah, that's what I was going to ask. Go ahead first. Sorry.
He doesn't know he's in Shadesmar, which I thought was interesting. Is that just because he can't see, or is that because he's always in Shadesmar?
I don't know. I feel like it's partly because he's always in Shadesmar, and I feel like, I don't know, I feel like this is just a gimmick of Nightblood is focused on very few things, and I feel like anything else, like where he is not even something that comes into Nightblood's mind, like just doesn't consider. So when Zeth is actually prompted to draw Nightblood, Nightblood is not a black consuming darkness, it is consuming, I suppose, but a bright beam of like brilliant light which is crazy. I wasn't expecting this. I was wondering how this might work, but I wanted to ask y'all why this might be or what you think. My guess, as I read this chapter, my assumption was this is how Nightblood sees itself. Like, Nightblood pictures Nightblood as a radiant, glowing beam of light, and that is what that's what his power is, you know, like that is Nightblood as it knows itself, you know, like that's my brief understanding. My assumption was it's all about the cognitive realm in Shadesmar, and that's how Nightblood self, like the self identity that Nightblood has is that, like that's how he sees himself. So did y'all think that at all, or something totally different? Or did you think about it at all?
I was really keyed into how Nightblood behaves in, like, mechanically, not like personality wise. I was really interested if he was still going to feed off Stormlight, which he does, and if he was still going to consume people into blackness, which he doesn't. He explodes people into light in Shadesmar. The Edge Dancer girl, like, explodes into a bunch of little sparks, which I thought was a cool visual. So Nightblood sees himself as, like, curing evil, light everywhere, I'm purifying the world of all this darkness, and everyone else sees it as, like, this all-consuming power of destruction. So I thought that was quite good.
The line is great. Glowing? I always glow, don't I?
Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
I don't know if I have too much more on Nightblood besides I assume Zeth will opt for Nightblood as default now as over his Spren or one of his Honor Blades.
Well, Nightblood is still crazy dangerous, right?
Right.
It absorbs investiture,
correct,
at a shocking rate. So
which it still did in Shadesmar.
Right. So whether it's black or white, it's still just as dangerous to the wielder and everything around him. So I think we still have to treat him very carefully.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't picture Zeth. I still picture Zeth, of course, keeping and wielding Nightblood, but in the seldom occasions like we've seen. Like, this is the second time, I believe, right, that Zeth has drawn Nightblood. Is this the second time, third, maybe?
He draws him at the end of Oathbringer, doesn't he?
That's what I was thinking.
Yes, when he fights, like, with Lyft.
The Thunderclast, right? Yeah.
Yes, yeah. I think that's the only other time.
Doesn't he draw him when he kills...
Kills Tanavat, or yeah, kills...
Teravangian.
Yeah.
Yes.
I know that Teravangian, like, consumes... it's a weird... I don't remember that scene as clearly, but I remember it was crazy because that's when we learned that Nightblood has a limit to the investiture that it can consume. It can't just consume...
Right.
A shard, like the shard of Odium. I was within that.
And if he hadn't consumed the corpse immediately, they would have recognized it as Rays and not Teravangian, but it ate the corpse, so they didn't know.
Yeah. Crazy. Okay, so three times. But, you know, obviously that will still be a seldom thing, but I kind of picture Zeth being on his own with Nightblood, not using Nightblood as, like, a guidance Spren, you know, like in that way, but just kind of coexisting, journeying together type of thing. I basically just see him getting away from his Spren and not being under some form of rule. Whoever else is with him, I don't know, if anyone.
Who's next in line to negatively influence Zeth, because he's just had one after the other so far.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Moash, you said it earlier.
Ba'inu Mishram?
Yeah. Ba'inu Mishram. Like, there's been the ominous stuff about that, the stone or whatever.
Mm.
Yeah, there's going to be more people. We're not done yet.
The Elstcolor guy falls on his own blade and disappears into purple smoke again. What's up with the purple smoke? Okay,
these Elstcolors, man.
No, the Stone Ward did it too. Okay, so Zeth kills the Stone Ward lady. The Stone Ward lady talks to him from the grave and then disappears into purple smoke. And then the Elstcolor guy falls on his blade and disappears into purple smoke. There's somebody illusioning these guys that they're not actually here. The Elstcolor, or I'm sorry, the Edge Dancer was actually there. I don't think the Stone Ward and the Elstcolor are actually there. I think we're going to have to face them again.
What if the Edge Dancer wasn't actually there, but Nightblood is just so freaking powerful that it like sucked through the fakeness of it all and actually killed the Edge Dancer, even straight though it was just a fake.
Yeah. Okay. I can see that.
I'm banking for that. I think that's awesome and crazy cool. Yeah, that's a good point. I remember that being such a vivid detail in that first monastery of like, she talked after she was stabbed with the shard blade. You can't do that. Like, that doesn't happen. And then poofing away. But I guess I didn't really consider it this time, but you're right. This really is like the video game quest, like beat these other bad guys. They kind of poof away and then like you have the final boss at the end. I'm wondering if this is, oh man, I don't know.
You got to beat all the mini Koopas before you get to Bowser or the castles, right?
Yeah, exactly. I'm kind of at a loss. I don't know. I'm waiting to see who's behind pulling the strings.
It's the Wizard of Oz. All right. Shallan, chapter 54. We have a little powwow in Relaine's memory of, is it the war camps or is it just the Shattered Plains in general? I think it's like where the war camps will be. Is that right? And then
I thought it was on, is it Narok, the city in the middle of the Shattered Plains where they lived?
No, because it's before they meet the humans, because he's got his little axe hound puppies. And then they flee to Narok.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you're probably right.
So, yeah, I believe it's what will be the war camps at one time. And this is pre that, and this is Relaine's vision. And then Ba'ed Amishram is hanging out everywhere in the stones, in the clouds, and in your water cup. What'd you guys get?
Okay, so I feel like I had a moment of where I was reconsidering with this chapter. So Ba'ed Amishram's face is like all over, and Shallan is, or they're kind of mentioning like, that shouldn't really be happening, but people keep thinking about Ba'ed Amishram, so it kind of allows her a window in a way to do so, to kind of spy on him. And it got me thinking a little bit. In short, I think that Shallan's storyline in this book with Renarin and Relaine is going to become extremely pivotal, if not one of the most pivotal parts of this story. I feel like they're all going to be very important, of course, like every character. But I think it's going to be way more than I was giving it credit for initially. I say that because, okay, so we have Dalinar, who's on his quest to find the history and to find honor. Right. And we're like, that's like the big thing. Like, you find the Shard of Honor that elevates you to another level. You can win the Contest of Champions, etc. Like, day is saved. That's kind of what that's hyped up to be, if you want to run with the ball. Then you have Zeth and Kaladin, who it's been slowly building up. It's been intense. It's been a whole lot of things. It's been challenging and it's been healing. It's a lot of stuff. But so much of all of these stories has hinged around what is going on with Ba'ed Amishram. Even thinking back to Kalak being kidnapped earlier in this book and other things like that, like there's a lot hinging on this with Ba'ed Amishram. The characters that we are following who are I feel like the ones who are going to encounter and come across Ba'ed O'Mishram, it feels like that's being set up, is Shallan, Relaine, and Renarin. And I don't know what that's going to mean. I don't know what's going to happen. We were initially, at the start of this book, thought like, oh, maybe she's not going to be bad. Maybe they're going to free her and she's going to be good in a way. And then you see all these scenes and moments about her and you're like, no, she's very evil, like very dangerous and evil. And no, we can't free her. But we don't know. It really, Trevor, you said Wizard of Oz a minute ago. I feel like Ba'ed O'Mishram is almost like a Wizard of Oz thing. Like, I'm going to withhold that. You know, obviously I'm saying that without any real information, but I feel like there's going to be a big surprise with that storyline. I think in some way, I don't know where, but that's my take. Is I think this is going to end up being way, way more important than I've initially been giving it credit for. So I'm planning to try and really tune in on these Shallan chapters, and just kind of dig in, see if I can figure anything out. So
I don't know if I have too much to add on the Ba'ed O'Mishram stuff besides I have a question. Does Ba'ed O'Mishram, is she actually there, like spying on them, waiting for them, knowing they're coming? Or are they just thinking about her so she shows up in the spiritual realm? Like, does Ba'ed O'Mishram know that they're about to come beat her up or set her free or whatever they're about to do? Or are they just thinking about her a lot?
I think Ba'ed O'Mishram is going to end up a lot like the Fused. I think Ba'ed O'Mishram has been imprisoned for so long. Ba'ed O'Mishram is going to be insane. Just raging, angry. If she gets out, she's just going to wreck everything in her path kind of event, which I think that probably is going to happen too. I don't think we would have teased it so much if it wasn't going to become part of the story. You know, if they just find Ba'ed O'Mishram and it's another gemstone with a dark cloud inside and they go, oh, great, and throw it to the bottom of the ocean and end of the story, that will feel very anticlimactic.
Well, okay, but at the same time, she's very much an Act 3 villain. Like, she wasn't really talked about at all until this book, right? Like, if the whole five books is one story, she's been introduced quite late, and if she has a huge pivotal role, I'll be kind of a little miffed.
I hear you, Trevor. However, it's one of the Unmade, right? And we've seen a lot with the Unmade, and we're kind of expecting to maybe know about each of them, each of the 10, right? 10, not 9, right? 10.
9.
9. Okay, each of the 9 by the end of this book, or I've been expecting that at least. So I understand what you're saying, but I do think it's relevant enough that there will at least be something going on here. I think we're going to have a later twist like this. Right now we're facing like, oh, Zeth had all these monasteries and Dalinar's learning some history. I think that's kind of my prediction, is that it's going to flip a little bit later where all of a sudden we're like, okay, I want another Shallan chapter right now because they're talking with, or I don't know, there's going to be some big reveals that maybe even so Dalinar is seeing, trying to see the history of the heralds and honor. Shallan may even stumble across the history, like the visions with, I don't know how exactly, but the visions and stuff with like the Unmade or something back in the day, which would be really cool and relevant there. But I do also see what you mean though, of like, we do have a lot of big things at hand. So I'm wondering how this fits in, but I don't know. I think something big is going to flip and I can't put my finger on it.
And let me caveat with this. I think she'll be very pivotal to the Spren with the Recreants, with having the Spren have a choice to give up their bonds, having the Spren, you know, not trust the humans anymore, not trust the singers anymore. All of that will be tied to the Ba'ed O'Mishram stuff. And I'm totally fine with that. But as far as like a full Fate of Roshar thing, I'd be kind of, what's the word I'm looking for? I'd be surprised if Bot and Amishram was fully tied to our main plot. Anything else? We have a little bit of Adolin before the end of day four. There's like a 3 or 4 page long argument between Adolin and Nura about Yonagon. He's not even in the scene. What'd you guys get out of this?
Trevor, is it you that have been big on the Adolin and Yonagon scenes so far?
Yeah, I've been very much enjoying it.
I thought this was a decent summary of what we've been seeing there, where Nura is not thrilled, saying Yonagon needs to be a figurehead. Yonagon needs to have no influences on him. And Adolin is really advocating for everybody needs a friend. Everybody needs somebody that they can lean on, that they can bounce ideas off of, that they can just be themselves with and learn from. And so very, very much a clash of ideologies, ways of treating people, I guess. I didn't have too many big thoughts on it other than different ways of approaching being a ruler, I guess.
Yeah, it kind of felt like just another, we're furthering to this point. There might be a breaking point where Yonagon will kind of decide whether he's going to live in his culture's identity for his role. Like that's the whole point against Adolin here, is like, no, this is not what he's supposed to be. He's a figurehead, right? He's a symbol of the, there's a lot of history tied into that and a lot of importance to their people for their leader to be strong, etc. But it's not a servant leadership role, which is what a lot of our primary leaders and characters have really taken on in this story, with Dalinar and Kaladin kind of taking on this mantle of, I'm not going to let people I lead do something if I'm not willing to do it, right? So that was a big point, Dalinar, and not to the same extent, but Adolin is instilling a little bit of that value in him with the, like, you know, it's very impactful for the men that you lead to see you even on the battlefield, instills a lot of courage and a lot of, yeah, it's just very honorable, I guess. And that's just not flying. So we're kind of getting up to that point where it feels like this is going where Yonagon is going to step out, maybe in battle capacity in some way, serve his people in that way. And that is not the quote unquote correct thing for him to do as their leader. So it's ruffling crazy feathers.
Ready for another one of my big predictions?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so Nura, in this discussion, says, either literally or figuratively, that Aesir is able to stand because he's on the throne. That because Yonagon is the figurehead, Aesir is able to function. Do you guys remember back in like day one and day two, we were all having the discussions of how does Odium take control of these kingdoms? And there's the loophole of taking control of the capital, right? What if that's not actually the case for Aesir and they've been hiding their contracts, their real contracts? And what if Yonagon dies and Aesir falls?
Maybe. They love their contracts, right? So for them to have gone a little rogue and modified their contract or negotiated their deal or added an addendum, that sounds very Aesir-ish to me. I guess, why? Maybe they were afraid that...
What if they're afraid of the Alethi and didn't tell the Alethi how their capital can fall?
Maybe.
I do see what you're saying, Trevor, and I think that's possible. However, for the same reason that they are, like, in the same logic of thinking that they are very, like, contracting and et cetera, like they could find a loophole type of thing. They're also very, like, I definitely believe that they're very firm on the leader being this, like, untouchable leader figure, that they would not ever put that as the, like, stipulation that, like, oh, if this guy dies, then we lose, you know, like.
But they keep having to put someone on the throne. That's why Yonagon's on the throne in the first place. What if there's no one on the throne if they're not actually a kingdom? And remember, Adolin, a couple chapters ago, had an assistant, and he offhand mentions, hey, can you go figure out what exactly the stipulation is for conquering this city? I need to know exactly what I needed to be defending. And she goes, oh, yeah, that could get important. I'll go find out. And she hasn't come back yet. What if it's Yonagon?
Okay, that's fair.
Could be.
Anyway, that's my prediction, is Adolin talks up Yonagon to go put on some shard play, and he dies, and we lose Aesir because of Adolin.
Man, that'd be a hard pill to swallow.
Yeah.
At some point, it'd have to come out. Like, the cat would have to come out of the bag of, like, no, like, look, Adolin, like, I'm going to pull you aside and be like, look, okay, do not tell anybody, but, like, you cannot take him to this battlefield because, like... Or at least Yonagon would need to know about this, right? And he would be like, look, I love this sentiment, but I can't go. I'm sorry, bro. Like, it's not for me, you know?
Yeah.
There's another interesting part of this chapter, at least for me, because it was something that was a bit divisive amongst fans and us. Adolin finally reminisces a little bit about the killing of Sadeas. Did you guys catch it in that chapter? It's just
3,000 pages later.
Yeah. Three more than probably. And he finally shows a little bit of remorse, a little bit, tiny bit of what I read. You could read this differently, perhaps, of remorse about killing Sadeas. I was going to read this and see what you guys thought. Not everyone murdered another high prince in a secluded hallway. Though Adolin stood by that action and would do it again, that was part of the weight. A better man might have found another way, and a better man certainly wouldn't have covered it up as he had. I actually like that bit of Adolin's character a lot. The fact that he's admitting that he's done things that maybe weren't the most righteous, and he says right there that he would do it again, but the fact that he's admitting a better man would have found another way, I think that's a step in his character of kind of re-examining his past actions and saying maybe there was a different way of doing that. Not that this is a huge massive flaw. We've talked about this in the past, right? Of did he kill a villain? Yes, he did. But did it the most honorable? No, it wasn't. And I think Adolin's coming to grips with that.
Yeah, I agree with you. I did notice it. And I have also been a loud critic of Adolin's actions at the end of Lords of Radiance. But yeah, it was good. Anything else before we end day 4? Okay. Elliot, do you have a theme for day 4?
Yeah, to try and sum up day 4, this was a pretty big one. This was where we first started to dive into the spiritual realm for the first time. We got exposure to what that was like. We've been waiting for that for a while. We got some really big Kaladin and Zeth moments in these chapters. So I felt like I needed to tie those into my takeaway from day 4. So what I got to as kind of a theme of day 4 was identity, but specifically in the sense of self-definition, if I can hyphenate that and kind of make that a single word. I think that would be what I would try and use as a theme here. This, what do you define yourself by, or what actions, what choices do you make that make you who you are? Because that came up a couple of times. There was a section with Zeth fairly early on where he says, I have a purpose. I am here because of my choices, and I am capable of making such decisions. I think that was that moment where some of the Kaladin influence was finally starting to get through, where they have the talk about, you know, thought soldiers and combating the bad thoughts in your head, and that kind of element of taking ownership of who he is and the choices that he makes. Those steps Azeth was making was, I think, pretty big in this day. And then Kaladin has some great conversations with Syl in this kind of beautiful chapter where he's reminiscing about the Wander Sail and Bridge 4, and he's dancing with Syl, and they're doing all this kind of fun stuff. But he's wrestling still with, who am I? If I don't have a bridge crew around me to protect, protecting others was my entire identity. Who am I without that? And kind of talking through that with Syl, and how do I define myself? It was all in there. And then even over in the Shallan storyline, she's having to reface Formless. Formless is back and right in front of her. And Shallan is having to face, who am I? Am I Formless? Am I Vale? Am I Shallan? Who am I? That's a common theme with Shallan, right? Probably all the way back to the beginning, but it's coming up yet again here in day 4 of Wind and Truth. And then to stretch it even a little bit further, Adolin, I think, is getting into some of this, who am I kinds of questions, where he opened up about, you know, being a Radiant, and why is he not a Radiant, as he's talking through this with Yonagon. And I don't like oaths, because I think you shouldn't make an oath and keep it just to keep it. And I think that kind of ties maybe a little bit into how Adolin defines himself. And then even on the fringes of this theme, you can tie in Nightblood and how Nightblood defines itself and the glowing light that we talked about in this chapter. And then even Yonagon. How does Yonagon define his role? Is it through the position that he holds, or is it through the active contributions that he can have as more of a leader, and kind of how Adolin is broaching that subject with him? So lots of self-discovery, self-definition in day 4.
Good work. All right. Two of our shortest word count interludes, but heaviest content interludes. We have Inquisitor Moash. Paul, this is the first... I always want to say mention, but that's not technically true. This is the first appearance of Moash in our book since Rhythm of War. Is he in the mental state you were expecting?
I would say no, not what I expected. I think the biggest change that I was not expecting is that Odium is not taking his pain. That was the big thing that we saw before. That was kind of... Moash kind of signed a deal with the devil because it took away his pain. Like, he got what he wanted. He got to not feel pain in exchange for doing horrible things. You know, being an arch nemesis and villain in every way. And here he is kind of sitting in the weight of this. He's blind. He's sitting in the weight of this, basically just tormented. Even amidst that, he's so bitter that he's not... He's unrelenting about it.
I do want to talk about that real quick. At the beginning of the chapter, Moash... I was very keyed into this because this was a huge discussion for like years going into Wind and Truth on Moash. What's going to happen with him? Does he deserve what he's getting? Blah, blah, blah. And to start the chapter, there's a little remorse. I killed my friends. I killed Teft. I backstabbed Kaladin. How could I do this? I'm a monster. And then Odium comes in. Well, hold on. Odium comes in. He then asks Odium to take his pain again, which doesn't happen. And then Odium feeds the, you're not a monster, a monster would do this out of spite, and you're doing this because it needs to be done. Like, he feeds in the lie of someone has to do this, and Moash quickly embraces that of like, yes, I am doing what needs to be done. I will bring justice all across the world to hundreds of other worlds, blah, blah, blah. He's looking for something. Odium feeds him this little thing, grabs onto it. But there is a little bit of, I can't believe I killed Teft right at the beginning of the chapter. And I don't know what to think about it.
It was almost like he was about to go down that path. And then Odium talks him out of it. Pushes him back into, you had a reason for all this. It had to be done. Ugh. Almost.
And it is tragic. I have this was a challenging chapter to read. I have mixed emotions still on, is that the path that Moash would have sought out? Would he really have broken down to a point of, yeah, like you're right. He did feel the regret and the remorse. And so a lot of people disagree, but I'm pretty lenient. I would go for a Moash redemption.
But he immediately wants out of it. He's not trying to dwell on it. He's seeking a way out of it. Odium walks in the room. He immediately says, take my pain, take my pain. He asks it like four or five times in the chapter. And Odium says, no, 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 we're going to give you more pain instead. So that's what I'm keyed into, is he's in such denial that he could kill his friends that he wants the pain to be taken away immediately so he doesn't have to think about it. That's where he is.
Yeah. Absolutely. And then you're right. Odium comes in, kind of feeds them this thought, this idea that's kind of his scapegoat. His like, oh, okay, no, this is all right because I'm enacting justice. The reason he set out was because he had been wronged. And that's why he set out on this mission to begin with. And so he's able to kind of scapegoat off of that, which is, it feels like a perfect storm of like, it feels like a series of unfortunate events, you know? Because Odium is getting a high class warrior, you know, the evil henchman, if you will. And he's also somewhat restoring his sight here. So we get the first, that we understand, allomantic spike on Roshar. It seems to function the same way as we have seen in other magic systems, though it is crystal. We talked about that before. And I'm assuming that is a Roshar thing. That was something we debated on of like, oh, is this an early version where they made it with crystal or something, or is this just what they had? Is it as effective? But we talked about the investiture on Roshar being in spheres, like these gem crystal spheres. So maybe this allomantic spikes are made out of crystal as well. And it seems to work. So in the same way, we get Inquisitor Moash, who does not see again, but can see an investiture in the same way that an Inquisitor can see. So it's a big improvement, at least. He can get around and make sense of things. And yeah.
Okay. Remind me of Inquisitor rules. What did he just get? Did he get some sort of allomantic power, or ferrochemical power, I should say?
Seeker?
Is that so? I know they have like the spikes in the rib cage, and that, like, depending on where you spike someone, it gives them a different power and what you spike them with. So feasibly, what did he just get?
Yeah, I think this is effectively like a seeker thing, right? Like a seeker.
So he can just see investiture. Like, is that
well,
it?
Well, yeah, and I like think sense. It's like sense investiture usage, isn't that it? Because the Inquisitors go around. And you can't, you know, do your allomancy when they're around because they'll know it's you unless you've got your
They can kind of like
cloud, copper cloud,
yeah. It's coming back.
Yeah, exactly that. So that's my understanding. Is this is mostly just giving him a way to see, to
okay,
be useful again with like visual, like to be able to get around and fight, etc.
But is he going to be able to see Spren? You know
how he says he sees Spren.
Yeah, he says he sees Spren, right?
Yeah.
Well, I have to go back and read that. I think I interpreted that as that's his best explanation of what he's seeing, because we've been explained this in the past. It's been a little while now, Mistborn, but he'll be able to see as these outlines of investiture of the world around him. He doesn't see normal sight. He sees through lights. I kind of took that as that's the best explanation he can come up with when he starts to see that, as he's seeing the Spren behind all the things. That's just kind of how a Rosharan might interpret that. But if he goes to battle against a Radiant, there's been protection in the past with the Spren not being visible.
Right.
But now, with this power,
all he sees.
Right. Is he going to be able to see? You know, we've talked about before, are we going to see deaths of Spren? Well, Moash might just have another tool in his arsenal to be able to hunt down Spren.
Hmm. We do know that in some way, shape, or forms, at least one of the Spren we know might not be around. Or there's theories of some different Spren we know might move about. So I don't know.
I would be surprised if Moash killed another Spren. He's already done that. I think Spren will die. I thought it would be at the hand of Fused or Skybreakers or, you know, something like that. But I don't know. Maybe Moash will go kill Spren.
I think that's going to be the, you know, Moash has been the way that Brandon has been able to encapsulate the most despicable things. That the utmost disrespect and despicable things, such as killing someone, then giving the bridge for salute. And then leaving, you know, like the things that really make your blood boil, you know, Teft, Yezrian, all these things that it's like, you didn't even need to do that. I thought Yezrian was sad.
No, but he really does have Teft, Yezrian, and Elokar. I guess I didn't really put that together yet. That wow. Mm-hmm.
No. Yeah, he's the one who's doing the actual dirty work of all the crazy bad things that have happened. And then not just doing it and running away, but making a scene and making it really hurt extra, more than just the initial loss. You know, like I said, the bridge for salute, like that's a direct emotional attack, you know? So I would not put it past them if they're going to fight dirty, of course. And they're like, the way to beat Kaladin is, what if you kill Syl? You know, like, if you kill Sylfrenna, his Spren, then, like, what's he going to do? You know, like what's next? Brandon has borderline turned them into a love interest, this book. So, like, what's going to happen there, you know? And so, yeah, there's lots of things that we've never considered the Spren dying. We have considered the Spren dying, but not in this way, I think. And that's got me pretty afraid for several of our characters. Because what happens if you're fighting and then suddenly your bond is gone? Like, you're not bonded to anything. Like, drop of a pin, like, change. That changes everything. And so, yeah, I'm nervous about this. I think we're going to see more Spren die. Also, I don't know, this is not going to happen, but on my bingo board, I have that Pattern dies, so...
You're holding out for a Pattern death?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to.
Oh, dear.
I was going to say, you sound like you're rooting for it over there.
Well, for my bingo board, yes. I'll take it, but I would...
We all know your bingo board's a wish list. We all know that.
Wow. Okay. A lot of it is, so this is hard for me to defend. I was going to say, honestly, we don't have to go into the weeds of it, but I think Pattern is like my favorite of our high spren characters. I absolutely love Pattern.
That is incorrect take.
It's my take, Trevor. So you can have your take. Anyways, moving forward, I think he does see spren, and I think he is going to kill spren if he can.
We get, Elliot, what is it, a page and a half of Odium interlude?
One page.
It's like a minute 20 seconds in the audiobook, maybe 2 minutes. And Odium goes and visits Carbranth, hugs his family, and says, "I need to kill everyone who's ever done wrong." There you go.
Yeah. This was interesting because we see a more emotional connection for Taravangian. We know that he cares about his like home city. That was like the deal he originally struck up with Odium. Was like, okay, you can destroy everything, just like please this one area. Like that was his moment of brilliance, just being able to save the people there. Like that was it. We see more specifically here, he is only acting in the interest of making sure his family cannot be touched.
Right.
Feeling like he's not even worthy of his family anymore. He has done too much wrong. But it does not matter. It is worth it if they cannot be touched and harmed. I don't have anything else to say other than that's crazy. It's just getting crazy out here.
Something that I noticed in this epigraph, or sorry, epigraph. It's not that short. Interlude is Taravangian has a law in Carbranth that the criminals are exiled. And he talks to himself of, that's not enough, I need to kill them. And in his original pact with Odium, he gets to protect everyone in every Carbranth and everyone who lives inside it. So that would in theory not include all these criminals that he's exiled. I just thought that was an interesting detail to include, that all the criminals of Carbranth are exiled. It may not be important, but it's been a detail that I've keyed into.
I think I just took away from this chapter that there appears to be no good side of Odium. I was hopeful in the past that emotional Taravangian could have a good influence on Odium, but it's chapters like this that make me think that's not possible. Because even when emotional Taravangian has full control of Odium, it still goes to a very dark place, like kill everyone that doesn't agree with me because I need to control everything. Yikes.
Yeah. We've had this, in my opinion, incredible dynamic of the divided one. And we're thinking it, I've been thinking of it naively. I think of like divided between what's right and what's wrong, maybe, or
that's not how I've been thinking about it, but
it's not that simple. But for lack of a better term, that way of to be more specific, divided in Taravangian has a ability to control, to have some control over the Shard of Odium, where others have not been able to our understanding. Some control where we even see it where he's kind of like, he's feeding it emotion. He's feeding Odium some emotion, and he's making decisions and working with cultivation, almost seeming like there's something positive or less destructive going to come of it. Not between good and evil. I wouldn't call any of his actions good. But there was a glimmer of hope that he has power over the Shard of Odium, therefore something could maybe change. And this may have been orchestrated by cultivation to change the cycle, to break the cycle and to have something different. I think I agree with what Elliot said, and I think he is divided, but I think both sides are headed very bad, headed very poorly. So
there's no happy ending for Odium. I don't think it's either tyrannical rule of the Cosmere or defeat.
Okay, I have a question for you guys. Moving even beyond Wind and Truth, zooming out a little bit. Mistborn Era 2 is set after Wind and Truth, and the Cosmere is not being ruled by Odium at the time, or as far as we know. And so my question for you is, what is the worst case scenario for the Cosmere that could end on Wind and Truth? Because Odium wants to leave Roshar, go parading around the Cosmere, conquering everybody, you know, war everywhere, death to everyone I disagree with, blah, blah, blah. That's not happening in the immediate aftermath of Wind and Truth. How does this end poorly? What's the worst ending you guys could think of for the Cosmere that doesn't have Odium just immediately conquering everything?
I think we can still have Odium on the warpath. I think you could still have Odium. It has broken free from Roshar and is on a crusade to destroy and control the entire Cosmere. Just hasn't gotten to the sphere of influence around Scadrial yet. And there's a problem. There's a problem coming. Spoilers a little bit here for Mistborn Era 2. Autonomy maybe is gearing up to be powerful enough to withstand Odium, you know, something like that. But kind of on the side, Odium is tearing through worlds and slowly conquering the Cosmere system by system, just is still decades away from coming after Scadrial.
Okay.
Yeah, I think maybe that might be a Mistborn Era 3 concern, potentially. I feel like we can't really glean much because I imagine that Brandon Sanderson was very careful with that. He couldn't be like, oh yeah, in Mistborn Era 2, we read that Odium is actually dominating the planet and threatening harmony. Well, obviously.
There's a meta answer, of course, but...
Yeah. Obviously, that's extreme. But giving too much information, even just the information that Odium is roaming through the Cosmere, absolutely, like, we're like, okay, well, we kind of know what's going to happen, I guess. You know, so I imagine he was very careful because this is a very prime story for him. I feel like this might be, as we get into the back half of the Cosmere, I feel like Mistborn Era 2 might face a similar situation to how, like, Elantris is now. Like, Elantris is, like, part of the Cosmere, but a lot is referenced back to it because of there was nothing else at the time it was written. You know, I feel like there's other things, lots of other things, big things that will happen that it's just could not have been written about yet at the time of Mistborn Era 2. So
it ends two ways for me. Either we solve Odium by the end of Wind and Truth, and Odium is not a continuing character, or the other way is at the very end of Wind and Truth, Odium, everyone who follows him, and Dalinar just disappear. And then we don't hear about them for thousands of years. And that, and the silence, is the scary part. Those are the two ways I see it going.
I could see, in our other plotline, we are exploring the concept of Shard is dead doesn't necessarily mean Shard is dead. So I could see if our heroes win, Odium is defeated and killed, but that doesn't mean that Odium can't become a problem again later. So could we wrap up Stormlight Era 1 with Odium is defeated? Yes. Can Odium still be a problem in Stormlight Era 2 and beyond? Also yes.
What happens if the shard of Odium is splintered on Roshar, you know?
Right.
We get a bunch of red spren zipping around everywhere.
I'm sure there'd be a lot of crazy stuff, yeah.
All right. Anything else for episode 244, gentlemen?
Man, great questions all around. Great discussion, I think. Like, there's a lot going on in even just a page of an interlude, right? Like, a lot of stuff. It's a rich book, and I'm excited to read more.
And we're only 4 days through it. We still got 6 more to go.
That's some good math from a top engineer. Thanks for joining me, Paul and Elliot. We will reconvene next week with chapters 55, 56, and 57.
See you later.
Toodles.